addition at the end there, which is not one I'm here to emphasize at the present time, but could get, is that going to trap me in language in the prison, what, who is it, Jameson, Frederick Jameson, the prison house of learning? And I don't think so. I really don't think so. And I think my own background in both Lonergan and Jung, from a psychological standpoint, is so focused on the pre-linguistic. Lonergan with insight as a preconception event, and Jung with these archetypal symbols that occur in dreams prior to language and across cultures. But I don't think, for me, that's an image. All I'm trying to do is to, with what I said at the end of the last session, just to open dialogue with two principal traditions of 20th century philosophy. To be in communication with them, to learn from them, and to say, well, maybe this is something that we, that the tradition I come out of, might be able to offer to them. So anyway, let's go on with Lonergan first. So number 13 in the notes. The principal concern of this chapter is not with the biological or the aesthetic or the intellectual pattern of the school, but with the dramatic pattern of everyday living, where we are concerned not only to get things done, but we know that we want to have some sense of dignity in our life. And Lonergan expresses that by talking about a desire to stamp our living with a style that is a work of art. Each one of us produces the first and only edition of himself or herself. And we want to be able to take a certain amount of satisfaction in that, to receive the respect, and even the affection of others for the job that we've done in making something worthwhile out of our lives. Not simply getting things done, but doing it in a way that has made our lives worth living. That's the dramatic pattern. And there are two things that come together to forge this dramatic pattern, and particularly to forge it in a way that is set for us before we have a choice as to what we're going to do about it. The two things that come together are the underlying exigencies of the neural process in ourselves. Exigencies for expression and conscious representation, on the one hand, our nervous systems, okay? And secondly, the situation of our lives, the situation of the subject's life, as it influences one's capacity and willingness to receive materials into consciousness. So two things then. There are neural demands for psychic representation. In all conscious animals, this would be the case, that the nervous system has a capacity above and beyond the meeting the underlying requirements of chemical and biological, beyond that, for the psychic representation, both Freud and Jung. Lonergan here is talking from his reading in Freudian and Jungian psychology, more Freudian in insight, more Jungian and existential psychology in his later work. But there's an excess of neural energy for both Freud and Jung that will find its complement only by coming into consciousness in the form of psychic representation through images and through affects. So there's that. And then on the other hand, what meets that underlying neural flow for psychic representation through images and affects is the concrete situation of one's own life. As that situation has influenced one to be ready to allow images to come into consciousness in the first place. combination of these two. In myself, there is a nervous system that wants expression through psychic representation and image and affect. But I am a part of a human situation that has influenced me in a certain way so that I'm either open to or closed to allowing certain things to come into consciousness in the first place. So first of all, the underlying neural materials. There are underlying neural materials in one's own body that have their own exigencies, their own demands. And these are met by granting them psychic representation and conscious integration and transformation. These exigencies are understood differently in different psychological systems. Consider, for instance, if you've had any background in depth psychology, the differences between Freud and Jung on psychic energy. For Freud, all of those neural demands that are above and beyond the chemical and the biological have basically a sexual meaning to them. The neural demands are for psychic representation in some kind of a sexual overtone to it. For Jung, it's far more generic than that. The sexual is only one of the different channels into which the psychic representation and neural demands can flow. Much less reductionistic than the whole question of dealing with the same matter, the psychic energy, energy becoming psychic. Nonetheless, both of these systems, as well as many others, will grant the fact of an exigence for psychic representation and conscious integration of the underlying neural flow. That conscious representation is in part a transformation of the biological under the guidance and direction of a kind of artistic motivation, a motivation to give dignity to one's existence. The category of dramatic artistry, this is Lonergan's category, dramatic artistry, artistry in the creation of one's own life in the company of others. This is a key notion in this chapter, that I want my life to be regarded by others as having some kind of dramatic aesthetic quality to it. I want people to regard me with respect as being something of a genuine person. And that's what he's getting at. Our social relationships are grounded in aesthetic liberation and artistic creativity, where the artistry is limited by biological exigence, inspired by example and emulation, confirmed by admiration and approval, sustained by respect and affection. So that's the first part, the neural demands of psychic representation. For Lonergan, the underlying exigence there is for dramatic artistry. Okay? That's the underlying finality, if you want, the word that he'll introduce later in the metaphysics. For this artistry, in everyday life. But secondly, the drama, I'm born into a drama. It doesn't start with me, with my birth. I'm born into a family. And that family may be functional or dysfunctional. And it may be more or less, either one. And the drama into which one is born, I might be born into a society that is torn by conflict, so that all I know is to think of people being born today in the Middle East. You know, all I want to know. The drama into which one is born molds one's character partly beyond one's own choice. You have no choice in some of the things. And it influences a prior collaboration on the part of imagination and intelligence that provides possibilities. Okay, it gives you the possibilities for reflection and evaluation, for judgment and decision. But there's a prior collaboration that allowing things to come into consciousness in the first place. So the way he expresses it, I've got a rather lengthy quote here. As other insights emerge and accumulate, so too do the insights that govern the imaginative projects of dramatic living. As other insights are corrected through the trial and error that give rise to further questions and yield still further complementary insights, so too does each individual discover and develop the possible roles one might play, and under the pressure of artistic and affective criteria, work out one's own selection and adaptation. out of the plasticity and exuberance of childhood through the discipline and the play of education, there gradually is formed the character of the person. It is a process in which rational consciousness, with its reflection and criticism, its deliberation and choice, exerts a decisive influence. I make choices, what I'm going to do with my life. Still, there's no deliberation or choice about being stamped with some character. There's no deliberation about the fact that our past behavior determines our present habitual attitudes. Nor is there any appreciable effect of our present good resolutions upon our future spontaneity. Before there can be reflection or criticism, evaluation or deliberation, our imaginations and intelligence must collaborate in representing the projected course of action that is to be submitted to reflection and criticism, to evaluation and decision. And this is a problem for a lot of people, that they just don't see enough possibilities. Kierkegaard, in the non-psychotherapeutic context, spoke about too little possibility. Some people just don't. They've got to be broken open. Already in the prior collaboration of imagination and intelligence, the dramatic pattern is operative, outlining how we might behave before others, and charging the outline with an artistic transformation of a more elementary aggressivity and affectivity. Ordinary living, it is a drama, but it's not ordinary drama. It's not learning a role and developing in oneself the feelings appropriate to its performance. It's not the prior task of assembling materials and through insight imposing upon them an artistic pattern. For in ordinary living, there are not first the materials and then the patterns, nor first the role and then the feelings. On the contrary, the materials that emerge in consciousness are already patterned, and the pattern is already charged emotionally and cognitively. There is a certain, we're already oriented in a certain direction to allow some things in and to keep some things out. Dramatic artistry is possible, so to make a work of art out of my life, only because there is a certain subordination of neural process to psychic determinations. So that I'm able, there's a flexibility. There's an initial detachment of our bodily movements from the directing sensitive and emotive elements. And he gives the example of how, for instance, one can learn to play the piano. And what that, the flexibility there relationship between the sensitive and emotive elements and the underlying bodily elements there. A variety of movements becomes possible through complex correlations between the psychic and the real. Nonetheless, there are neural demands for psychic representation and conscious integration. They must be allowed to come into consciousness. And they are met in the patterned experience in which the elements enter consciousness. The elements are somehow pre-consciously selected and arranged. As the dramatic pattern penetrates below the surface of consciousness to exercise its own domination and control, and to effect prior to conscious discrimination its own selections and arrangements. And this can be very deep, this can be really organic in people. We'll come to that in a moment, just in terms of a couple of examples. Penetrating below the surface of consciousness to exercise a domination and to effect its own selections and arrangements. And exclude other selections. This is the meaning that Lonergan gives to Freud's notion of the sensor. Neural demands or neural demand functions call for some psychic representation and some conscious integration. But their specific requirements can be met in a variety of different manners. But still, there are limits to this versatility and flexibility, and they cannot be neglected without a heavy price being paid. I think here, one of the meanings, at least, of dreams of flying can mean that you're neglecting the limits of the underlying neural materials. That's not the only meaning that those dreams can take. It has to depend on the context. And the meaning of the interpretation of the dream has to feel the way the dream felt. But that some dreams of flying are indications that people are leaving their limits behind and not respecting the limits of their underlying neural exigencies. Okay, this business of the penetrating below and selecting, a couple of things that come to me on this. There was a quotation that was pointed out to me by Max Scheler in his book, The Essential Mind. Have I mentioned this already? The organic, where Scheler in his book Ressentiment speaks about organic mendacity. There are some people who are so programmed to lie that they don't even have to decide. It's organic. The underlying pattern is so set that their whole life is a lie. And it's not even a matter of conscious decision in a given instance to tell a lie. Racism is another instance of an organic pattern, the way you let materials in the first place. And one instance of something that we had here a number of years ago was the speaker, Rosemary Houghton, who came. She's an extremely creative and a very engaging speaker. She, like Lonergan, is a person who demands conversion in every paragraph that she writes or delivers. And that can be threatening. And after her talk, someone who said, you talk about this and you talk about that, but you never mentioned the good things in our Catholic tradition. And Rosemary said, well, I mentioned this, and I mentioned Saint so-and-so, and I mentioned another saint, and I mentioned several popes, and I wasn't being critical at all in that. And I thought that I was expressing great loyalty to our Catholic tradition and all of this. And she is a very loyal Catholic. And this person said, I didn't hear that. And Rosemary, she said, you didn't hear it because you came programmed not to hear things. You just were not ready. Now, whether that was true or not, she's getting at, the way we can be so patterned that there are some things that just were not.
So, this organic tendency towards mendacity, is this from birth in some people? Like they're just born?
No, I don't think so.
So it doesn't mess around with free will in that case. You can program yourself to tell lies instinctively, so that
we can be programmed in the course of our lives. Who knows what I don't know what the genesis of psychopathic disorder is, sociopathic disorder. There are a number. Lonergan will talk about the individual bias or the egoist. Well, that's something that's very much under a person's control. But then there are categories of psychopathology like narcissism, and then even more so the psychopathic, that are not exactly what he's talking about when he speaks about the individual bias or the egoist. And with the psychopathic personality has no conscience. And I don't know where that comes from. Are they wired that way? Or are they, nurture, a lack of nurture? I haven't yet read a satisfactory understanding. It's the one psychological classification that has baffled me in my encounters. So I was told in one instance of my life by a psychiatrist that I was dealing with a psychopathic personality and I should be very careful. So that was frightening to me, but he said the person has no conscience and simply continues to take it. I don't know where that comes from. But it was organic in the person. Organic calculation. Calculating. Everything was calculated for his own interests.
It's wrong.
I was wondering what you guys.
Affects are just like feelings or.
Well, I think it's, yeah, I think it's a general, it's a generalized word that, but see, feelings can be, they can extend all the way from sort of primitive affective responses to all the way to self-sacrifice and love. So feelings, I think, includes a lot more probably than affects. Affects would be more or less spontaneous emotional responses. Chris?
Could you say a little bit more about the limits of neural demand functions, that the versatility and flexibility that we can't transgress at a certain point?
Yeah. I could say it in a couple of ways. There are underlying exigences to that you must meet for food and sleep and so on. You can't drive yourself beyond those limits without bringing harm to yourself and probably to the people who are at least in your immediate environments. So there are limits that are placed on what you're able to do with these. There's a tremendous amount of flexibility that the human body has for movement, and it will differ from one person to another. I mean, some people will probably never be able to be great musicians or whatever, but their greatness or their skills can be manifested in a lot of other ways. But they can't neglect the underlying needs for nourishment and sleep without burning out. Burnout would be an instance of neglecting the limits.
So does that just pertain to biological kinds of functions?
No. What was the other thing that I was going to talk about the limits? I had another thing in mind. It was more than that. Was the biological was just one instance of the manifestations that can occur. It's in chapter 15. We'll see that Lonergan will talk about limitation and transcendence, and genuineness is living in the tension of limitation and transcendence. Transcendence here, not with a religious meaning, but simply the meaning of going beyond. Okay? Human genuineness is living in the tension of limitation and transcendence. Not displacing that tension in either direction. Kierkegaard will talk about, I find Kierkegaard really helpful for this, in the concept of bread. He will talk about the person who lives with too little possibility. And the person who lives with too much possibility. The person who lives with too much possibility is the one who tries to do what is not their thing to do, you know? I mean, you might be able, I don't know, but you might be able to be a great athlete. If I had set my goals, my sights on that, my life would be a failure, you know? Because that just wasn't in the cards. I mean, I just was not wired that way, or whatever you want to say.
Come on.
You know, does that make sense? So you got to know what your limits are, and they're going to be different for each of us. And we got to know what our capacities are, and they're going to be different for each of us. And then to live in the tension there of the limitation and transcendence. The person of too little possibility is the person who falls into depression. The person of too much possibility. Some of the problem is that the roots of some of these are organic, so you've got to be careful. There are psychic roots to depression. There are organic roots to depression. I'm talking about psychic roots now. Okay. okay? And the same thing with schizophrenics, okay? Schizophrenia at times is organic in its roots, but at other times it may be psychogenic. When it's psychogenic, it's too much possibility. There's no grounding.
Mm.
There's no ground, period, you know? And so you get the person who's flying, you know? Well, we don't fly like this, you know? We don't. That's not a logical disquisition. But that's, you know, yeah. And they're going to be different for a different difference. Anyway, yes, Robin.
Yeah, I just have a clarification. The relationships between experience, understanding, judgment, and decision,
yes,
all occur within specific patterns of experience.
Yes, yes. Yeah. They do. The four levels of consciousness are in all the patterns of experience. Yes.
So any judgment made is made within, you know, it's either within a biological pattern or an intellectual pattern, and so on.
Whether the judgment that's made has gone through a lot of reflection and so on, particularly in a biological pattern where, you know, the judgment's got to be made like that, but you do make, I think you make judgments on here to get out of here. It's not only a sense. I see the four levels of consciousness functioning in all the patterns and in all the differentiations of consciousness. There's insight in art, and insight in art is expressed in the artistic product. But when does the artist let that go? When you should know that this is it. And that's analogous to the judgment based on the grasp of the virtue and the condition of insufficient evidence. So there's this kind of judgment that takes place there. And then they decide to release it. Yes.
If you take the natural sciences,
yes,
would those be analogous to patterns of experience? So if they're biology or chemistry or physics?
They're all in the intellectual pattern.
But they are specific ways of intelligently organizing data.
Yes, yeah. But they would all be functions of the intellectual pattern of experience. But there would be experience, the gathering of data, understanding, the judgment that comes through verification. And then decision functions in different ways. I mean, there's what are we going to do with the results, the decision to release the results. And there are, as we know, a lot of questions that have been raised by contemporary philosophers and science about the moral responsibilities of science. So, yeah, now those are all functions of decision. Okay, let's see what else we're able to do. And here's where we have that little flexibility that's opened up by the extra class that schedule was out of. All right, the prior selecting and arranging, this is what we've been talking about, can be dominated by a bias. Now the bias, the term bias always, it has a connotation to it of imputing blame or guilt, and it doesn't mean it that way, and particularly with this dramatic bias, which is a bias that is instilled in us beyond our free will. It can be dominated by a bias so that the materials for needed insight are prevented from ever emerging into consciousness. Insight can be unwanted, and unwanted not in the sense that the person has made up his or her mind, no, I'm not going to, it's just that there are certain things that perhaps they can't face. And the long-term results of that kind of bias are described on pages 214 and 15. This is a lengthy quote from the book. To exclude an insight is also to exclude the further questions that will arise from it and the complementary insights that will carry it towards a rounded and balanced view. To lack that fuller view results in behavior that generates misunderstanding, both in ourselves and in others. To suffer such incomprehension favors a withdrawal from the outer drama of human living into the inner drama of fantasy. This introversion, which overcomes the extroversion native to the biological pattern of experience, generates in some people now a differentiation of the persona that appears before others and the more intimate ego that in the daydream is at once the main actor and the sole spectator. Finally, the incomprehension, isolation, and duality rob the development of one's common sense of some part, greater or less, of the corrections and the assurance that result from learning accurately the tested insights of others and from submitting one's own insights to the criticism based on others' experience and development. So there's that. There is a bias and pattern into us. Prevent certain things from coming into consciousness. And the longer that goes on, the more estranged we become and the more alienated and the more distant. The aberration of intelligence that exercises the repressive center sensor is called by one of the scotosis. And the blind spot is scotoma. Whether we use that language or not. It's the only time he mentions it, really, so it's not very important. The scotosis is fundamentally, but not exclusively, unconscious. It shows itself in the censorship that we are patterned to exercise over the emergence of images and their concomitant effect. Just as wanting an insight penetrates below the surface to bring forth schematic images that give rise to the insight, so not wanting an insight has the opposite effect of repressing from consciousness a scheme that will suggest the insight. Now, this aberration of the censorship is inverse to it. Primarily, the censorship is constructive. It selects and arranges materials. We can't deal with everything. We have to. We have to fragment or differentiate and sort out. Not so much fragment. We have to limit. So it selects and arranges materials that emerge in consciousness in a perspective that gives rise to an insight. This positive activity has, by implication, a negative aspect. For other materials are left behind, other perspectives are not brought to light. Still, this negative aspect of positive activity doesn't introduce any arrangement or perspective to the unconscious demand functions of neural patterns and processes. They're just left behind. But in contrast, the aberration of the censorship is primarily repressive. Its positive activity is to prevent the emergence into consciousness of perspectives that would give rise to unwanted insights. It introduces, so to speak, the exclusion of arrangements into the field of the unconscious. It dictates the manner in which neural demand functions are not to be met. And the negative aspect of its positive activity is the admission to consciousness of any material in any other arrangement or perspective. Finally, both the censorship and its aberration differ from conscious advertence to a possible mode of behavior and conscious refusal to behave in that fashion. So it's very different. That's not what he's talking about. The censorship and its aberration are operative prior to conscious advertence, and they regard directly not how we are to behave, but what we are to understand. If I refuse to behave in a given manner, that's not a refusal to understand. So far from preventing conscious advertence, the refusal intensifies, makes me more aware, makes its recurrence more likely. Finally, while it is true that conscious refusal is connected with a cessation the conscious advertence, still this connection rests not on a darkening of intelligence, a revelation of intelligence, but on a shift of effort in interest preoccupation. Accordingly, Lonergan says, I'm led to restrict the name repression to the exercise of the aberrant censorship that is engaged in preventing insight. And I'm just adding my own things here. Lonergan claims that the censorship is exercised by a prior collaboration of intelligence and imagination. Imagination here suggests a psychic as well as an intellectual component. And the notion of psychic conversion entails a release of that psychic component into the freedom to let be what is available to come into consciousness. Those of you who are in my other course, what we took in the last class is my understanding of the way in which basically allowing oneself to be loved, and love meaning one at the place of one's deepest hurt, is what opens up that psychic component. The scotosis is really a function of both intelligence and psyche collaborating to keep certain data out, as Lonergan says at the bottom of page 215. Scotosis is an aberration not only of the understanding but also of the censorship. Still, as he says on page 223, the scope of our work in this book leaves no room for an account of the existence on the level of the sensitive psyche of an initiating factor that operates in a parallel fashion to the flight from understanding. So he's leaving that question open about something at the level of the psyche itself that is resistant to understanding. Well, I think that has to be dealt with, and that's what I've tried to deal with in the notion of psychic conversion. Are we clear on what he's saying? Yes, Mark?
That flight from understanding, though, that's not a conscious thing.
No, in this instance, he's not talking about a conscious, or certainly not a deliberate flight from understanding.
In the beginning, we were talking about the accumulation of insights that get handed down, related insights to the individual. Now, those are related by whom? By the community or by the individual?
Well, they are in the community, and they're handed down to you as the community has related them and associated them.
So they're not necessarily
whatever your community is. You know, your family has. Connected with the culture and so on and so forth.
So they're not necessarily insights as an activity of the individual?
Of the individual, no, they're not. There's an element of understanding that's involved in them, but it's that receptive understanding that I'm talking about. But what we need to do is to subject them to our own creative inquiry, you know, and we need to, we all have to do that. I mean, if we're going to make up our minds about the decisions even that we have to play as responsible civic figures, you know, I mean, like who you're going to vote for the mayor of Toronto in the next week. Well, you've got to submit a lot of meanings and values that have come at you to your own critical inquiry to make a responsible decision or something like that. But the meanings and values have come to you, and I mean, the candidates represent different sets of meanings and values. Just take that as an instance. Well, you can receive those. You can't make an informed decision until you have done your own experience, understanding, judgment, decision, your own creative inquiry into it. So, yeah. And we have to do that. Yes.
So then, to go ahead with this example, would it be like, I can't hear, you know, that someone's talking about, or your example before, like, I didn't hear you talking about those Catholic saints. Is that the schemata then?
No. Scotoma.
Scotoma?
Yeah. It is.
And that is the scotoma?
Yeah.
It prevents you from attending to relevant data.
So then, what is a neural domain function?
It's the underlying excess of energy beyond what is required for you as a vegetative, chemical, biological unit for conscious representation. We are oriented towards experience. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's that underlying, our neural system reaches integration only in psychic experience,
mm-hmm.
in images, concomitant affects, sensations, emotions, and so on. Okay. So there's an underlying exigence for that, for that kind of expression. Those expressions in images and affects are the materials that we then use for insight into the situations in our lives and so on and so forth.
They're psychically determined in images and affects.
But there are, if there are certain insights that I can't do or don't want to do, then there's something that patterns out, filters out the images that could give rise to those insights.
So that affects.
They don't come into consciousness in the first place. The materials that could give rise to them will not come into consciousness.
So that affects the psychic determination, not the neural demand. The neural demand's already there, but it's the psychic. It's how it's
expressed.
Presented.
The same. The same thing can be exemplified, I think, in repressive or totalitarian societies that will not allow certain images to reach the public.
Okay.
I mean, even in the United States, there are images of what has gone on in certain military engagements of the U.S. that are simply not, they don't get on CNN.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just understood that the public will not see these. Well, that's a public repression of images that, if they were seen, could give rise to insight that might lead to judgments and decisions that would change the course of events.
I see.
Okay.
That's helpful. Thank you.
But the same, there's something very similar that functions in our own. Okay. We can have our own internal police, if you want, you know, that will not allow certain things into consciousness.
And those decisions can be both conscious and unconscious.
Yeah, like the ones that I'm talking about, I think it was a lot of conscious decisions. I mean, this is if some of the materials that I was just reading again Chomsky last night, but he spoke about the situation in Laos back in 1975. was never released. But it was something about the, forget exactly what the details were, but there were images that he said the public never saw in the U.S., but they were the effects of U.S. military policy in Southeast Asia. So, if you can believe it, but I do not believe it. But, I mean, his point, Lonergan's point here, in the next chapter he'll be talking more about that kind of stuff, but in this chapter he's talking about the way that can happen in our own internal, the interrelations of our own. I mean, we have our own internal repressors.
Mm-hmm.
We'll keep sort of things out. Okay, it's 4:00, so we will stop. And we will pick up from this point next week. And this opens up then a little bit more. I'm glad that on that extra class, since we are telling you that really. I want to give this stuff as careful of reading this. It will be very important that you move into
the four Americans in the class. We could celebrate Thanksgiving on that day. And the teacher, at least four.
Oh, next.
Put that to the vote now.
May I remind you of the event next? You've probably been reminded in a lot of classes this week. I've been asking the faculty to remind people of it, but you really are all cordially invited to any or all of the event next Friday afternoon. It starts with a social hour with hors d'oeuvres and wine and lunch around 4:00 or period. There's a slide presentation on Icons of Wisdom by Bill McNichols at 5:00. McNichols is a very prominent world renowned iconographer. And he's done an icon of the lottery. We'll comment on that as part of the presentation. You are invited over to the Lonergan Research Institute to view the icon if you've never seen it. That will be around after his presentation. And then after a break for supper, we're back at 7:30 with Fred Lawrence, and the wine will still be out. Well, we did this last year in our workshop, so people came back and they were delighted to see that they could have a glass of wine as they were listening to the lecturer, who was moi. And so if there's any left, it will still be up for the evening. But Fred Lawrence speaking on grace and friendship. It's a good event. It was a wonderful day last year. And I'm expecting this. So you're most fortunate, right? And spread it around, everybody. Your brains there will be spread.